do I have a show for you. CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories. I have UBC Improv, an interview with them today. I have Liam Dolan coming on to tell some stories. I have Quinlan McCormack talking about research and people watching and performance art. First, though, this is Passive. My Mind is Not a Temple. CITR 101.9. This is Textbook.
Means of communicating 3,000 years of habit in terms of diapering of babies.
Well, please tell me more.
Because radio reaches people, including those hard-to-get young people. Radio goes where they go and talks their language, recognizing the importance of contemporary sound.
And the sounds are instantly recognizable as belonging to the in-groups currently on top of the charts.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
I am Josh. I'm here with members of the UBC Improv group, the UBC Improv Club. Do you guys want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Sophia, and I'm one of the co-presidents of UBC Improv.
I am Maddie Rafter, and I do the promotion stuff and also do improv.
Hi, I'm Trang Nguyen. I am UBC Improv social coordinator, and I also do improv.
My name is Dita Sue Bilgin, and I am on UBC Improv, but I also do some of the graphic design for the club.
Give me a little bit of sense of what you guys do day to day. I know you have performances weekly, bi-weekly?
Yeah, we have bi-weekly performances that we perform in Scarf 100, one of the lecture halls on campus. And then we have four teams in our club. Three are regular performance teams, and one is a showcase team. And performance teams practice twice a week, and the showcase team practices once a week.
And you're also competing. Is that the idea? Are there competitions? No competitions.
We don't compete on a bi-monthly basis, but we do participate in what's called the College Improv Tournament every year, which takes place in Seattle.
Mm. Oh, we also have November 15th at Café de Soleil. We have a mini improv tournament. It's called Improv Fight Club, and we're going to be competing against Trinity Western's University Improv group. So that should be fun.
There seems like there's a real like improv community in Vancouver. I know there's Sunday Service as well, which is really big.
Love it. Love to serve.
Why is it? Why is Vancouver such a hotspot for improv?
That's a really good question.
It's a saucy question.
Yeah. I think a lot of improvisers, especially the older ones that take it more seriously, they come from acting backgrounds and they come from theater backgrounds. And I think Vancouver is just a hot spot for all of that kind of stuff. And improv is a really good way of kind of exercising different forms of theater. Mm-hmm. So I think people are really interested in that.
What does improv look like as a practice? I mean, what do rehearsals look like?
Essentially, we meet, the performance teams meet two times a week and showcase meets once a week. And during the practices, we'll do a couple warm-ups to get ourselves ready, and then we'll start doing our set based on the form that is given to us by our coaches. And that form will vary from something like a domino to...
A Harold.
Yeah. And
LaRonde.
Those are simple terms for just the different formats of how a practice can go or a show can go. So depending on character or setting or location.
Give me an example of it. What is the Harold?
Harold is sort of like the main structure, like form. One of the really common ones in improv. And it was created by Del Close and
Turner Halpern.
Gotta give credit where credit is due. but basically, it's a structure of a set, and it has three linear stories that go throughout. You'll do the beginning of story A, B, and C, and then the middle of story A, B, and C, and then the end of story A, B, and C. So you're seeing three separate stories, but with threads throughout the entire thing.
And intercepted between them are these things we call games, which can... be repetitive notions, just something to separate the beginning, middle, and end. Mm-hmm.
So how much time would something like a Harold take?
Depends. I mean, we usually do like 20, 25 minute sets. But I guess it varies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen Harolds take place anywhere from 5 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
What are, let's talk about your biggest fears on stage. If we're talking about time, I mean, I imagine one of the really big risks is that it just goes on. What else are you freaking out about when you're up there?
Ooh. Yeah, it just, like, takes a lot of guts to get up there and do stuff.
I think I usually worry about if my hair looks good.
Yeah.
It gets, like, really hot in Scarf 100, and it's, like, really frizzy.
Sweating too
much. You're, like, really sweaty.
Yeah, I think one of my biggest fears is letting my scene partner not look good or do something that kind of, like, jeopardizes them.
Yeah.
There's, like a big thing that we practice a lot in improv, and that's to make your scene partner look better than you, mm-hmm. which I think is a great thing to live by in general.
I do. I like that a lot.
Yeah, that's a good serious answer to that question.
I think... whenever I get on stage, I usually don't hear when people laugh. I wish I did. I really wish I did, but I can't hear it, and I don't know if it's going well or not.
Yeah.
And then I'll only know once I'm off stage on the side and just thinking about how it went. So I think one of my biggest fears is probably, like, making eye contact with somebody in the audience and having them not laugh.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, it's just, like, I think audience members generally have this idea that, like, we're so confident and we like can get up on stage and bang out these jokes, but like it's so hard to go up there and not know what you're doing and just like be handed something and do something with it. So I think just like nervous.
This is just a question for me. I'm just wondering, have you guys ever been approached by anybody and said, oh, you're from UBC Improv? Have you like on the bus or anything like that?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Is it weird?
Yeah. That's super awkward.
I think they expect you to be all woohoo. Yeah, but it's you're quite normal.
Is that what the shows are like? What is the atmosphere of the show? Can you describe that to you?
They're crazy.
Yeah, the audience is crazy. I think it can actually, they're just so pumped to be there, I think, which is awesome.
It's
like, we're so lucky
audience.
To have a great audience like that. It almost can be a little bit distracting sometimes, just because when people really are laughing at things that maybe we feel in practice are not, would not be as good as, okay, wait.
No, like the oddball thing that people laugh at, and then you just get kind of, oh.
Yeah, like maybe something will be laughed at that we wouldn't think is really good, and we're like, why are they laughing at that? Like, it's making me feel like it's throwing me off.
Totally. I think the audience is just super keen on being a part of the process of the show and being a part of this, like, collaborative thing, because improv is made up on the spot, and the audience fully knows that, and they accept that, and they know that things that we put out onto the stage, the audience is going to either really like that or not really like that, and then we can kind of move forward from there. It's kind of like a give and take with the audience.
Yeah, that was actually part of Jonah's question. We had a phone-in question from Jonah, and he was wondering, I mean, yeah, this claim of theater made on the spot.
It's claim.
Yeah. He's wondering how true it
like
is.
Like finger quotes. Wow.
And how much does the kind of the form of the set, like a Harold, drive the content? I'm wondering how you guys would respond.
I think it gives the backbone, but the content and the substance is very much on the spot. It's whatever prompt we get from the audience. It's how the scenes are going. I think a form just gives us maybe a good way to end it, essentially.
How seriously do you take the, I guess, challenge of being original or improvised?
It's definitely a challenge, but I think definitely in practice we try to aim for doing things that are outside of our comfort zone or things that are outside of our static characters, so characters that we tend to play really often. I think, and I think I can say this for all of us being women, it's really difficult to play characters that are characters that women play a lot. I think that's a challenge that female comedians face a lot of the time.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that some more. What are the characters that you find you're gravitating towards, or maybe that you feel are kind of pressed on you? Does anybody want to speak to that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting, both the people that you're improvising with and also the audience sort of have conceptions of what those stereotypical or like those tropes are of characters. And so often I'll be on stage and I'll have in my own head who I am. And I think I'm just often more comfortable playing more like male or like masculine characters. And then someone will like give me like a female name or like say her. And it's sort of just like funny to see the ideas that people have about who you should be playing on stage. And even if you're doing something that may be associated with masculinity, that like someone else will project yourself on you. And I think it's really hard for people to separate like you as an improviser and like a person from like what you're doing on stage.
Like a lot of times I think I could be playing a male character in my mind and then be endowed as a female by another player on stage just because they assume like, but it also goes the other way too. Like I will call like a guy playing a lady like Mr. Sanchez or something. I'm like totally botch the scene. No, it doesn't. It's fine.
Well, even with, I don't know, stereotypic, let's say, power move, like a male character, even if you come out as kind of like a hunky person, you don't have to be male. You can be female, too. But it's already so set in those archetypes. Sometimes it's hard to just get out of it.
Yeah. How does kind of the raunchiness of the shows play into that? I mean, you're describing an atmosphere where a lot of people are really riled up. Maybe there's a little bit of alcohol too. I mean, how does the raunchiness, does that get in the way?
I think at times, if one of the players says something that's a little suggestive and the audience is really good at picking up on that, but I think also because the audience that we're playing towards are like-minded, intelligent university students, there's definitely like a threshold of how taboo we can go. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really good for us so that we can kind of stay on track and not lose the story we're trying to tell, or like the quality of the narrative. I find that American improv is a lot more taboo, and they really like to stretch those boundaries and go for things that are a lot more racy, a lot more...
The wow factor.
Yeah, the wow factor, whereas Canadian improv is really, really interested in doing really good narratives.
We aim for art. Settle. Aim for art, settle for comedy. No, that's true. As nice. I say.
We, like, American improv aims for one-liners. But we also, I think at our shows, we get kids and parents, and we sometimes get a wide range of people that come in. So, I don't know, I think it's important that we stick to our guns.
And, of course, like, those raunchy jokes are always funny, like, initially, but I think the payoff is much more satisfying to watch, like, characters develop a relationship and go through their problem, and I think the audience prefers watching, like, a story that we've created on the spot rather than just, like, us throwing out, like, a wanky joke.
What do you feel you've learned on stage? Have there been any really big takeaways through your time doing improv?
Whoa.
I know.
I think for me, just being comfortable being kooky in front of people and really just letting go of caring about what people are thinking about you. Like, maybe you're doing something super weird and someone might think, oh, that's a weird person. But I don't know. I think just improv is super, like, forgiving of weirdness and really, I don't know, embraces it, I think. And I don't know, it's very freeing.
I hear you guys also do workshops and you've had some odd requests. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, we get contacted by a lot of people to do either shows at their events that they're holding or come in and, like, teach their people about improv. And sometimes they're very normal requests, but yeah, we've had a few oddballs in our past.
Yeah, we've had everything from solder case competition prep to grandma's birthday.
I just want to know the reaction of grandma. When people come in, was she expecting improvisers?
I mean, I wasn't present for that event, but I could imagine it was wild.
Grandma's 70th, bringing in the improv team.
What about Jacob?
Yes, our good friend Traffic. He's the guy.
Oh, Traffic? Is
yeah,
that his Traffic?
His name. That's his rapper name, I think.
Okay, so this was last year. We had a rapper who I think is also a student at UBC, and he wanted us to, I guess, kind of dance in the background of his music video.
I don't think it was dance. I think he wanted an interactive session.
I think he wanted us as extras. Maybe we just wanted... He wanted people in the background of his video to look, like, cool and chill and like they were having a good time.
We're the opposite of cool.
We're not cool.
The video itself ended up looking really great.
I think, you saw it?
Yeah, guys, it's online. Check it out. Yo, anyone who's listening, YouTube, Traffic, check out his video.
I can play it at the end of this.
Yeah, I don't remember what song it is. I remember there's a line about a Honda, maybe.
Yeah. And we were all pretending to drive a car.
Basically, I think we were not the aesthetic he needed, but we enjoyed it
but
still.
But it's lovely getting requests like that.
Yeah, and it's so cool, like, collaborating with other people on campus as well.
Yeah, branching out.
Because, yeah, I think there's so much talent here, and it's exciting to see sort of the ideas people have. And, I mean, we do these shows, like these regular shows. And so it's so fun to try things outside of that.
Yeah. I think us as a club, we offer this skill set of improvisation that is so useful in so many different realms of life. I mean, I can totally see it translating to a business case competition. Like, why not?
Why not?
Big public speaking, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, totally. Public speaking, accepting offers.
Mm-hmm.
When you fail, where do you go from there? Like, so many.
Yeah, giving focus and...
Tell me about some of your favorite characters or sketches from the past year. And I don't want to, you know, there's nothing worse than explaining a joke. But if there's some that have really struck out at you from this year, describe it for me a little bit.
At our most recent show, our great friend and fellow player, Tom Black, he did this hilarious character where he played a police officer that was the best officer in the town, but he was a horrible officer, and there was like maybe two or three in the town, and he was making Yelp reviews, and he met up with a criminal who's sitting right beside me,
Ricky Sanchez,
who didn't know that they were a criminal, and it was just, yeah, it was so fun.
What's next for UBC Improv?
What isn't next?
Yeah.
There's a lot that's not next. Next in the...
This week,
we have a show on Friday. This is one of our rare back-to-back shows. So we had one last week, and we're having another one this week because we know how much you guys want to see us.
And if you guys want to cheer us on at Café de Soleil on November 15th against Trinity Western U Improv, that would be sweet.
Yeah. We also have some cool sort of charity event things going on. This coming show on Friday, we have a group of people on UBC Improv who've formed a Movember team. So they're raising money for that to raise awareness on men's health. And so they're going to be taking donations at our show. And then November 18th, we're teaming up with UBC Rec. They're doing their Lace Up for Kids campaign. And so all the money that we make at our show on November 18th will go to their campaign.
You heard it here first. Thank you so much for coming to speak with me today. Everybody, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was good.
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire,
Cheetos,
fleece material,
and Discorder.
It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heckin' want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute.
Just visit CITR.ca/discorder/contribute.
You can grab it around town or read it at discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.
Hello, it's Textbook. My name is Josh. This is CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live, unceded Coast Salish Territories, University of British Columbia. Today on the show, I have Liam. Liam, introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Liam Dolan of the University of British Columbia, student here for 5 years now.
You're in your fifth year.
Fifth
the victory
year.
Lap. What are you studying?
Sociology.
How's that been?
It's been pretty good. This year, I'm taking a lot of 100 level courses, though, which is not very fun for me. But other than that, it's been pretty good.
I really like the way in the past you've described how, like, when you first started, the buildings, there were just like a couple of buildings. I don't know, like how the building, the whole landscape has changed.
Yeah,
I find like what we see a lot of buildings go up.
Totally. I mean, I think the overall aesthetic of UBC has changed so much in the past 4 years. It's almost like it's got a totally different artistic direction.
Yeah, it's totally got a totally different face.
In the buildings. I went to the aquatic center today and saw kind of the old vibe, and it was interesting to...
What were you doing at the aquatic center?
Sleeping, because I do it when I'm depressed.
We got a really, really cheery episode for you here.
Great.
When did you... So you moved to Vancouver to go to school from Portland.
Yeah.
How was that?
Yeah.
Do you remember, like, the trip up?
Yeah. I it was like my actual, I think it was my second time being in Vancouver when I first came here, despite living pretty close by. And right. I remember kind of thinking it was like Blade Runner. It looked a lot like Blade Runner. So I thought that was pretty cool. But it was definitely like a big aesthetic change and cultural change from Portland.
Yeah.
And it took a lot of getting used to. And there's kind of just like a different, I guess like a different endorsement of the arts in Portland than there was at like my first year in UBC. And it was kind of hard to get used to, I guess.
Yeah.
Because I kind of felt like I had a niche in Portland, but yeah, I don't know. I've definitely like become more acclimatized to Vancouver since then. So.
Yeah, it's a weird city though.
Yeah.
I think also is something to keep in mind.
It is. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the stress around money and yeah, it definitely makes it kind of, there's kind of a financial and like corporate aesthetic stress on art here. It's, which makes it kind of difficult to operate sometimes.
Yeah, I definitely sense that too. Tell me a little bit about where you're living in Portland and your neighbor.
So we live kind of in Southeast Portland, and yeah, we have several nice neighbors. A lot of our neighbors are pretty conservative, but like a lot of kind of liberal families have been moving in recently since I've been gone. But we have one neighbor who's this Australian guy, and we, I don't know, my family's started to have a lot of quarrels with him at first. We were kind of on good terms.
Quarrels.
And, yeah, so basically my neighbor had this fire pit in his backyard that was really close to our garage that's filled with a lot of gasoline and paint thinner. And the garage itself is kind of falling apart, and the shingles, there's just a bunch of leaves on the roof, so it's basically like a bomb. And our neighbor had his fire pit really close by, and my dad kind of went over there and was like, hey, can you move the fire pit? And he's like, you don't tell me what to do in my backyard. And then slammed the door on my dad. So my dad was like, all right. And then, you know, like against my mom's advising, he kind of like took a couple of pictures of where the fire pit was located for the insurance company. And little did he know, my neighbor's kids thought that he was taking pictures of them, and then went and told their dad. And he stormed over and was like, my dad's name is Tom. He's like, Tom, you fucking pervert. You're taking pictures of my kids. And my dad just kind of sat there dumbfounded, and like my neighbor was kind of puffing out his chest. And then my dad was like, no, I was taking pictures for insurance photos. And he's like, Michael didn't respond, and he just walked away. I don't know if that's not his actual name. My neighbor. But yeah, and since then they've had kind of a lot of different quarrels, and my neighbor allegedly put this broken vacuum in our driveway.
Allegedly, as in like your parents have accused him of doing this, and like exactly. There's probably little grounds for it.
Yeah, exactly. And then my mom put a little sign on the vacuum and put it on the sidewalk, says, whose is this? And then apparently it was later found in Michael's driveway.
Oh, wow.
Again, not his actual name.
This is petty, man. Putting a broken vacuum cleaner.
Yeah. And then, I don't know. I think their whole family, like, there's just this big family feud going on right now. And I think both, like, I don't know. I obviously side with my parents because I think logically their argument stands better than his does.
That's the only reason that you're saying with them in the family feud.
Exactly.
But it started when you left, after you've left, right?
Or started after I left. Okay. So like before I left, we were like on pretty good terms. Like my family was on good terms with them. But now, now it's really tense when I go back. Like recently, some of his construction employees yelled at my dad just for like, I'm sick of you like watching what we're doing and like you're such a weird, like, perverted guy to Michael's kids, and you're just trying to, like, over-survey him, and, like, you won't let him just fix up the house. He's trying to fix up the neighborhood. He's trying to get, like, an Airbnb in here so people can enjoy it. And meanwhile, like, my dad was just at the bottom of our steps by our house, just looking at them from afar, and then she just yelled at him.
What has your interaction been like with this neighbor?
It's been fine. I mean, I worked for him for years. I was a construction worker.
For the neighbor?
Yeah.
You've been working for him?
Yeah. Well, not during this feud, obviously, but before the feud.
Okay.
So I still talk to him. I mean, it's funny because, like, his kids just will not talk to me. Like, they hate my family.
Wow.
And one time I was talking to him, and his kids came by, and I was like, hey, what's up, guys? And then they looked at me, and they just frowned and, like, walked away. And then he's like, so I ought to limb. But, yeah, I don't know. It's been pretty stressful for everyone involved. I think, at this point, it's kind of reached a critical mass.
What were you telling me about how he noticed that you were staying up late a lot?
Yeah. When I used to work for him, I'd tell him what I do the night before, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, me and my friends recorded music, pretty late. And he's like, oh, yeah, I heard that. Kind of a night owl, aren't you? And, I had to agree. Yes, I'm a night owl.
I didn't know that part of it, that he was saying you're a night owl because you were keeping him up at night with your racket.
Exactly. Well, it's more of my friend trying to record, like, drum takes over and over again when he doesn't have a sense of rhythm.
But, tell me about your music making. Tell me about what you're doing in Portland, what you're doing up here.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I started started being in bands, I guess, when I was, like, 13 or 14, and used to play shows in Portland at, like, these different places. We had, like, one place where my friend signed on as the CEO of, because it was, like, a nonprofit. And
oh, wow.
He, like, wrote himself into the tax record. So it was this, like, anarchist bookstore. We used to play there all the time. It got shut down because, like, there's just beer all over the books because of the shows. Like, it got all messed up in there. And also my friend used to stand at the door and charge people different amounts of money. He'd be like, this girl came up, and she's like, how much is it? He's like, $300. And she's like, what? You're joking. He's like, no, I'm not. It's $300. And then I was like, Paul, stop. And he's like, what, dude? And then one of our friends' dads came by, and he's like, no dads allowed. And the guy's like, what? He's like, no dads allowed. And the guy's like, you can't tell me not to come in. Paul's like, yes, I can.
Wait, is Paul the one that has a CEO-ship of an anarchist bookshop?
Yeah, before it shut down.
You don't see anything kind of silly about that, being the CEO.
He was definitely just joking around, I think.
And just ended up on this.
Yeah, because he ended up volunteering for them a bunch, mm-hmm. and then just, like, yeah, took control, I guess.
What was, what was your first show in Portland like?
Well, yeah, our first show, like, it's basically this company contacted us, and they're like, hey, we really want to support local bands. Like, we'll, like, get you a show if you can sell tickets. And we're like, okay. And then they give us the tickets, and they're these, like, terrible paper photocopy tickets that they want to sell. They want us to sell them for $15. So we're like, no one's going to buy this. Like, it feels so, like, pretentious to go up to your friends and be like, hey, you want to come to my show for $15?
Man, it's the oldest trick in the book, the whole, like, pre-sale of tickets.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, totally.
You have to sell them to play the show. Like,
yeah, and they were kind of like, yeah, we really want to support local bands. And I was like, if you want to support local bands, like, this is just not a great way to do it.
Right.
But, yeah, basically, we got there and we hadn't sold any of these tickets. And we're like, oh, well, we just told people to come to the door. And they're like, well, that's not good enough. We're going to have to cut your set time a little bit. And I was like, okay, well, it should be fine. Our set's pretty short. And then, before we go up, there's this, like, kind of guitar center power metal band. Like, they went up. It was like 40-year-olds.
Oh, my God.
Kind of, like, shredding and stuff. Yeah. And had, like, big, like, technical amps and stuff. And we're just like, uh-oh. And also, like, we had jokingly agreed that we were going to do it in dresses because our friend really wanted to, like, sew dresses for us. So we did end up doing that. So we got up there in dresses, and we played a couple songs which were hilariously Elliot Smith covers.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was your first show?
Yeah. Then we had, like, one original song. And after, like, the third song, I was like, all right, our next song is going to be, and then I hear a voice from the mixer in the back, and the guy's like, there is no next song. Get off stage. And then we're like, oh. And then he just turns on the background music, and we just left. But strangely, the bouncer, who's this really, really buff guy, was like, I loved you guys.
Oh, my God.
You guys are such a breath of fresh air. So that it wasn't all bad, but I remember going home and I can't remember if I cried, but probably did.
The first fan, though.
Yeah, that's true. An unexpected fan.
Breath of fresh air with Elliot Smith coming in there. Who knew, right?
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah.
What about up here? Who are you playing with now?
Now I'm in a band called Mirepoix with a local staple named Aguajo Palace, Ivana, Besanovsky, Grant Whitaker, and Dan Thau. We're kind of just like a rock band. We played UBC Block Party, Live at Lunch.
Live at Lunch. Yeah. Oh, yeah, CITR.
And what else? We played Music Waste. And we're going to play a show with the band Dumb.
Their tape release, right?
Yeah, we're playing that show, and then we're going to play a show with Testopia pretty soon, too, I think.
Hey, and you guys playing Shindig, right?
I think so, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, don't drop out.
Yeah, no, I mean, Shindig is a little bit stressful, but, you know, we'll do it. I think a lot of the band members are in it to win it. I'm not, because I'm a pacifist, but... But yeah, it should be interesting.
What's it been like playing music up in Vancouver?
It's actually been great compared to Portland, which is, you know, maybe contradicts what I was saying before, but like, I think in Portland there's just a very kind of competitive, established DIY culture there.
Right.
And people don't want to listen to your music. You have to, like, make it look like you're really cool in order for them to, okay, like, pay any attention to you or to talk to you. And that sounds like extreme, but it's pretty true. It's pretty, I don't know, there's a very strict social hierarchy there.
Yeah, as much as there's all the anarchist stuff.
It's totally.
Clicky. Yeah,
totally. And Vancouver's been pretty relatively open, which mm-hmm. is great, and people are kind of pretty stoked to play shows with you, mm-hmm. and we'll maybe, like, take a minute to listen to your music and talk to you.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's a social hierarchy that's pretty intense here too, but not nearly as bad as Portland.
Yeah, I feel that. What's it been like trying to kind of balance music and school?
It's been pretty difficult. I think, like, I don't feel like I get quite enough time to mess around with music stuff just because I feel like I could be spending my time trying to get better grades.
I feel that. You're kind of like, you can't spend enough time on either, really.
Yeah. And then, like, my downtime, sometimes I'm just like, I need to really relax. And I don't see, like, sometimes I feel like music wouldn't be relaxing, but it usually is. Like, I don't know, I usually get very, like, the most relaxed when I play music and kind of engaged in it, but, like, sometimes I just feel like I don't have enough energy to, like, start recording something,
right?
So I won't, and I'll just watch YouTube or whatever.
Right, yeah. The good old tube.
Yeah, I gotta get off YouTube.
Yeah, I know, that'd be a good thing to quit. Like, just cold turkey.
Yeah, I mean, I quit Facebook cold turkey.
Yeah, you did, pretty much. Didn't you?
And then, yeah, and then I kind of use YouTube as, like, a surrogate, and it's an awful surrogate because I, like, just got into blog culture a bunch, just as kind of, like, I don't know, I just like to look at it from an outside perspective, and just, it's, I got sucked into it, and it's terrible. And then I've been, like, trying to research the alt-right.
through vlogs?
Through vlogs, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And comments.
What has that been
like? It's been upsetting.
Right.
Like, it's pretty upsetting. Because just the platform of YouTube, I don't think, allows for you know, it doesn't really allow for an impactful, empathetic conversation. You know what I mean? It's not built for that.
It's not built for much, I don't know, nuance, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I think there's definitely something to say for, like, the technology has definitely created the structure that allows for something like the alt-right to exist.
Right.
And, I mean, this new dichotomy that people have between social justice warriors and the alt-right, which I think is a completely false dichotomy.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, what is it about the structure, specifically of vlogs, that get you so stoked on them?
Vlogs themselves? I don't know. Like, I think I've been watching this guy called Casey Neistat, and he's, like, a pretty famous blogger. And personally, I'm not a huge fan because, like, I mean, I respect what he does, but he's just kind of all about, like, encouraging kind of, like, new creative classmen to, like, rise up and make a living off of what they do. And it's just kind of, like, he's kind of, like, trying to make a case for the new American dream, which is kind of this, like, you know, like, startup American dream that's going on.
That's a good tech startup American dream.
And I personally, I think it's really not a sustainable thing. And he's just like a very fluke chance of that success. Because, I mean, the guy just gets like endorsements from drones and like.
Yeah, like, what's his MO? What kind of stuff does he do?
It's just like he lives in New York City and he has all these vlogs that he basically does of his daily life, and he has like this big like work studio thing and then an apartment in Manhattan, and basically it just is like showcasing this privileged lifestyle that kind of people try to live vicariously through. And I mean, like, that's cool, but that's not a model for the world.
Right.
It's actually not cool either.
But
I don't know. And then there's so many people that just kind of try to emulate that, like, on YouTube, and they're not privileged, and people are bored by it.
Yeah, right.
Because they're
right.
Not privileged.
There's also, I don't know, there's also just something so funny about, like, talking to this imagined audience.
Yeah.
You're just like, hey, guys, what's up?
Yeah, it's fascinating because, like, I think he talks about how it's kind of his therapy, and even, like, he'll have conversations with his wife where it's like, oh, man, they're going to get divorced. And, like, he will, like, just have really intimate conversations with the camera as if it's, you know, some sort of, like, narrative creator in his life.
Yeah.
Like, he has no, like, that's where he gets his narrative from.
It's
his own editing, which
right.
is pretty interesting.
It is really interesting. What do you mean about, he'll have conversation of his wife that he'll upload, like, what
he'll do like a, well, for instance, he did this like Q&A with him and his wife.
Jeez.
And they're talking about their marriage troubles, and he'd previously exposed that he was going to marriage counseling.
Okay.
And then someone asked this question. They're like, where do you see yourself in 10 years? And his wife's like, either married or divorced.
Jeez.
And then he just kind of laughed, and then I don't know, it was just a very kind of weird, it was very intimate, I guess. And
yeah.
It kind of, like, made me realize that this can't all be about, like, show. This is definitely, it has to do with this guy's personal life narrative. And it's definitely of importance to his own.
His own sense of self.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally.
Have you ever recorded a vlog?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, I haven't.
You never have?
I've recorded some joke vlogs. Like,
okay.
I have this YouTube channel. Where I pretend to be a Swedish DJ, and I do, like, different kind of, like, think pieces. Fake vlog thing. And what I've done so far is just, like, pretended I was on Vice and was getting interviewed, and that I moved to the United States, and that I found it very inspiring that, you know, there was very harsh textures in the U.S., and I have this Australian roommate who just chews me out all the time and calls me fake.
Wait, is the Vice interview thing because you were interviewed by Vice that one time?
No. This is we just, like, my friend Ben, who you've met, like, he had a camera and he was, like, filming me, And while he was filming me, I had my computer camera on me, and I was doing a vlog on that. So I kind of just showed him filming me.
Okay.
And made it seem like Vice was there, but I don't know. It's just kind of it's a parody on kind of like some of the electronic music channels on YouTube that I've been watching, and also I plan to do some gear reviews.
Oh,
pretty soon.
Yeah, gear review.
Yeah. So I'm gonna do some reviews of samplers and
stuff.
Give
us a taste. Give us a taste. You're tantalizing. Dancing around it. Give us a taste.
So recently I got this piece of gear. It's Swedish. It's called the Octatrack. It's made by this company Electron, and I was gonna do a review on it. And I was gonna kind of talk about it and be I really like this piece of gear because it's got a very creative workflow, and you can really mash stuff together. It's kind of like when I was born in the very north hemisphere, I didn't see much sunshine. All I saw was different animals. And I got very inspired by the sounds they made because I could not see the animals, but they made sounds. So I'm probably going to use this as my first creative workflow sampler, and then I might upload something to Ableton, the best editing program. Something like that, but maybe a little more rehearsed.
I mean, there's something so funny about the pauses and cadences that people take up when they're doing vlogs too. Yeah. These long and sighs.
Yeah,
and
especially with just gear videos, because usually the camera is focused on the gear, and then this person has this monotone dialogue about the gear. And it's funny, especially to me, with these indie manufacturers of gear, that people will kind of fetishize things like workflow and creativity, creative interfaces. And especially kind of Swedish European musicians, electronic musicians.
We're talking trance.
Yeah, yeah. trance, techno. I don't know, that kind of stuff. And then maybe even to the newer stuff like Avicii or some of the new inspiring guys.
The Scandies.
Yeah.
The Scandies.
And I got part of the inspiration for this from watching a video of Avicii in the studio, kind of giving lessons on how to make beats.
Yeah.
So I was like, man, I got to do that.
You're on Ableton now, right? I remember you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Are you using a lot, or are you just
Yeah, I mean, I like Ableton. I need to figure out how to use it better, because I'm kind of I was raised with GarageBand and Logic. So I don't know. I kind of got to get more into it. But recently I've been working with a lot of hardware stuff.
Oh, cool.
Like the Octatrack sampler, and then my keyboard, the X7, and a bunch of effects processors and stuff.
Sweet. Are you doing that with Mirpoint at all, or is that kind of on the side?
It's on the side right now. They want to integrate it somehow into Mirpoint, but I don't know. What I'm thinking about doing is just releasing kind of a sample-based album under, I don't know. I mean, I like using different names because I like, playing with image and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I like being really self-conscious of my own image when it comes to sharing music and stuff like that. I was thinking about doing it under the name San Moyle. I don't know. We'll see if that pans out.
Hey, I'm looking forward to that, man.
Yeah, we'll see.
I'll keep my eye out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know. A lot of times I'll come up with all these grand project ideas and just not do it because I struggle with seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah. It's not a good season right now.
Yeah, and depression. So it's just I get kind of bedridden sometimes, or just YouTube ridden.
I'd love to see that project, man. You should release it.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I'm pretty stoked. I hope it comes through.
Sweet. I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Liam, thanks for coming on.
Yeah,
thanks for spending the time, dude.
Thanks for having me, man.
I appreciate it. I'm going to... We're going to switch to a quick ad, and then there's going to be a interview I did earlier today with Quinn.
My girlfriend.
Yeah, Liam's girlfriend, about performance and people watching and stuff. Up next after this program, top of the hour, it's Discorder Radio. So, get ready for that. But first, here's a little ad for Shindig. This is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you so much for listening.
biggest musical competition in the country.
CITR is hosting our 33rd annual Shindig. It's a battle of the bands at Pat's Pub every Tuesday night.
We've curated 27 rad bands to compete for the title.
Who will take the crown from last year's winners late spring? Come to find out. Fun fact, at this year's Shindig, there'll be fun facts for beers.
Thanks to this year's sponsors, AMS Events, Backline Musician Services, Canadian Music Week, Discorder, Fader Master Studios, Rain City Recorders, Mint Records, Music Waste, Nimbus Recording, Thunderbird Radio Hell, Sixcent Press, Silver Fox Postery, Band Merch Canada, Blue Light Studios, Zulu Records, Fernie Brewing, and Print Print.
Come out this week, November 8th, to see Yeast Jerk in the Can.
Here today with Quinley McCormack. Quinn, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
We are here to talk about a performance piece that you've been researching and working on. Tell me a little bit about this piece.
All right. So, yeah, I'm in a performance art class here at UBC right now, and this is our first performance. And I decided to... Well, I guess maybe I'll tell you, like, what I actually did, and then I'll do a bit of background story. So it was called... 60 eggs, ibuprofen, and I went into class and I took an ibuprofen and then I cracked 60 eggs into a bowl. It took about 15 minutes and then that was it.
And what was the inspiration for this piece?
So I saw this guy about a couple of years ago at a Safeway, and he was this like old kind of frail man, and he just bought 60 eggs, like 5 cartons of eggs and a bottle of ibuprofen. So I decided to kind of like take that and like take my like people watching and like turn this like man into a muse, because he did this kind of like thing that was very strange and really, really struck me for some reason. And just kind of think about like how we create rituals. And how, like, me taking this man's ritual and then turning it into a ritual in, like, as a performance created a lot of, like, really strange meanings for different people in the class, even though it was, like, pretty ambiguous. And even for myself, I, like, invented meanings to, like, the act that I was doing.
What sort of meanings were people suggesting in the class?
I think, like, especially since... Since I'm a woman, a lot of people were like comparing it to like ovulation and menstruation, especially because like the ibuprofen and the eggs. And that was like something that I had kind of considered, like I had thought about it before when I was coming up with this project, but it definitely wasn't like the meaning to it. So it was interesting to see how just like since I'm a woman, that was like the like idea of what it was like about.
Right, when you kind of, even though the original act that
was like
inspired
done by a man,
by an old man, there's something really compelling about people watching.
I love people watching. Yeah, definitely. I was like a very shy kid, so all I did was like people watch, and like. I'm really sad right now because I live in a basement apartment, and like I love like sitting at the window and like people watching, and I can't.
What's your favorite? I mean, yeah, definitely from the window, the comfort of your own house is the best place to
watch. Yeah,
because
then like people don't like, yeah, you have like your privacy while you're like intruding on everyone else's,
right,
kind of.
Right.
But yeah, that's like my favorite place to people watch, just like for comfort, like my own comfort. But I think like, honestly, I think malls are a really good place to people watch. I haven't been to a mall in years, but.
Malls are kind of these relics too.
Yeah.
People that visit malls usually have a real purpose for being there.
Yeah.
I don't know, actually, maybe teenagers still hang out at the mall.
I don't know.
I wouldn't be able to tell you.
I have no idea.
So in a sense, the research for this piece was you watching this man. That was the research. And you're hoping to develop that some more.
Yeah, so I guess the research was, yeah, me watching him. And then part of it, too, is that I had to go to Safeway and buy 5 cartons of eggs and ibuprofen. So it was really, like, putting myself in his shoes. And I, like, it was weird because, like, adopting his, like, since I had thought about it so much, I had, like, just built up, like, how strange it was for some reason to me. So then when I did it, I was, like, very self-conscious, like, just, like, in the, like, yogurt and egg aisle, just, like, I kept on adding eggs to my basket. It felt so strange. And then, like, yeah, checking out was like, oh, geez, like, I look like such a weirdo.
Right.
But, I mean, like, when I saw that guy, I was just kind of like, huh. You know, like, I wasn't, yeah.
There's something, I mean, about the everyday in that, too, that it's this really kind of mundane thing of buying eggs, but it's sort of in excessive quantities.
Mm-hmm.
So many eggs.
Yeah, which was, like, I was like, what? Why is he doing with all those eggs?
Did you have any guess as to why?
I mean, I don't know. It's like, it was kind of something that made me a little sad too watching it. And I guess like I shouldn't like project my like, you know, my like ideas onto him. But like, I was like, oh, he's kind of like this old guy. And, you know, he's like buying ibuprofen because he's older and he probably like has pains. And like, you know, maybe he lives by himself and lives off of eggs, which I don't know. Maybe he was just going to, like, a church, like, pancake breakfast, and he was in charge of bringing all the eggs.
Were you able to, I mean, with that emotional response, were you able to tap into that or learn something more about that when you yourself kind of enacted it by buying those eggs?
I think, like, part of it, too, is that, like, since I went in to buy all this stuff with the, like, knowledge that I was going to use it for a performance, it was a little bit, like, it wasn't exactly what I would have wanted to do. But I think that, like, in the future, what I'd like to do, because I'd like to keep doing this performance art, like, based on people watching. But I think what I'd like to do in the future is just reenact, like, people's actions, and then reenact them again in class, whereas, like, this one I had to reenact his action and then do something else with it in class. So maybe I'll be a little bit more, like, choosy about the people watching that I do and use for my work.
Is this just mean? Is this just gawking at somebody on the street or, you know, in this case, in the grocery store, buying a lot of eggs?
I don't think so, because I definitely recognize that, like, you know, I have patterns just like that too. Like, I go to the grocery store and I always get two things of tofu, and I always get two cans of chickpeas, and I always do I have those like same like things. And I think that everyone has those rituals that they do in public spaces that may not be like super atypical or typical. I don't think it's mean, because he was kind of like my muse for the project, and like I wasn't trying to poke fun at him. I was just trying to like step into his shoes a little bit.
Right.
Which I don't think is a bad practice to do for when you see people every day, yeah.
Do you a lot of performance art? You have your own kind of visual arts practice. What does that consist of?
So this is actually my first performance art piece, because of this class. But I'd really like to get into it a lot. It's like kind of nerve-wracking, but a ton of fun. But I mostly do a lot of drawing, and some like textile work, and a little bit of, yeah, you know, a little bit of everything. I don't know. I'm still like finding my niche of stuff that I like to do.
You were also talking before about this kind of sense that you were capturing an outsider. Do you feel that that has some sort of connection with your art as well, that this kind of outside perspective?
Yeah, I think the whole act of people watching is, like, seeing, like, you pay special attention to, like, the qualities and the actions that people do that you think are, like strange, which is just like people watching is just a process of like othering someone, you know? So I think, and I think that like a lot of my work is in a very like personal realm kind of. I don't like, yeah. So I think that since it's in kind of this